Yesterday, we, probably most all of us, in one way or another, celebrated romantic love, it being Valentine's Day, as it was, which honors a form of love most relevant in every one of our lives at one point or another, and in a way, our very existence. Maybe it's my age speaking a bit, but today I want to move the emphasis over to a form of love less hormone-driven, and which is also a, if not the, most important aspect of our various ways to love, be we old or young. I was asked a few months ago to fill in for Nancy, who had a schedule conflict, and to perform a memorial service for a fellow from North Carolina. It was a military event down at Quantico for a Navy veteran who spent his lifetime after his military service teaching little kids in Montessori schools. The widow sent me a very complete obituary, a few personal comments from her and others, and a copy of his favorite book, a children's book of all things, with no explanation as to why it was his favorite. And here it is, Dog Heaven, written and illustrated by Cynthia Rylett, published by Blue Sky Press in 1995. It doesn't really have a storyline, but rather is a description of a dog heaven which God created in a unique way. Instead of a heavenly realm of clouds and angel wings, dog heaven is, in this case, an array of endless fields and woods where a dog can do its favorite thing, run and bark and chase and be chased, where there are a lot of angel children, because dogs love children. And there are dog biscuits in the shape of kitty cats and squirrels and ham sandwiches, couches to lie on and tables to sit under. And on and on. God appears in the illustrations as a white-haired and bearded old man lurking behind trees and rocks, taking great pleasure in what he saw. That is to say, a dog being a dog, doing what its nature compels for the moment. And he was most pleased with that. The book, in short, suggests God's love for a creature on the creature's own terms, in its own fullness, and living, in this case, its heavenly life according to its own nature. It is a description of what I would deem to be unconditional love, that is, being open to the fullness of another being, on that being's own terms and speaking that being's own language. And it hit me why it was his favorite book. You can't lecture a child to self-discovery. You can't really educe, draw from another what hasn't yet been discovered by them, unless your understanding and acceptance of who and where they are in their life is to them both visible and felt. Oh, to be sure, you can enforce regulations and rules, and you can lecture and call that teaching, and it is in a truncated sort of way, but it falls short of leading to much self-discovery. This truth is built into the Montessori approach to education, and as a teacher and educer, if you will, one needs to keep working at it. Dog Heaven served as a reminder of that truth for him. I would love to have known this man. In the Montessori system, there's a red line painted on the floor, and the children are seated along that line a couple of times a day to do certain things. Our teacher did it differently. He would have them stand along the line and grab their behinds with both hands. And someone once asked him what was the point of that, and he responded by saying, "I'm not really sure I can help any of these kids, but at least twice a day, I know they can find their rear ends with both hands." And that might just give him a leg up along the way through life. Huh? I'm not referring in these comments this morning to a kind of love which is as full of ardor and blind hormones as romantic love, or at least so often it seems to be, nor to a love that is characterized by collapsing one's boundaries in order to feel oneness with another, nor a state of mind that negates one's self or subordinates one's own being to another. I mean rather an openness to another in his or her entirety and a recognition of the divinity of God, many would say, in whomever it is that we have encountered. And I mean to be sure that it is an openness without reservation and without discounting or disqualifying any aspect of the other or the other's experience of life. This is not an easy thing to do. There's an old saw, "I love mankind, it's individual people I can't stand." And at the big UU church in San Francisco, where I interned back in the mid-1980s, I was amazed to see people coming to the church and hurriedly stepping over the homeless who were lying on the steps, often slept there, while in their hurry to get to the meeting inside to talk about feeding the starving in Ethiopia. It's something we all have to recognize as operative in our life to one extent or another. Abstractions are always easier to deal with than concrete others right there in our face. And of all of the difficulties we have with it, the greater difficulty for me and most of us, I suspect, tends to lie in our family or close-in relationships more so than with the wider world. Family members and intimates have the capacity to hurt us. Heaven forbid they might not embrace our well-thought-out value structures or our current truths pointing to the nature of it all, or our sense of justice. They may have habits or ways or attitudes that are strange and annoying to us. These differences tend to surface around mealtime, in my experience. Eating together is a learning experience in that respect, I think. Interestingly, the only known sacrament of Jesus of Nazareth was eating together with those close to him, and often with others as well. Maybe indeed the business of being able to be open to others in all their virtues and with all their warts alike, just as they are, and do so without reservation, may have been a mainstay of Jesus' method as a teacher. Anyway, this has certainly been so for me. I, like most others, I have always had a well-defended core of ego-based mental and emotional structures. Much like a castle with moats and drawbridges and the such, protecting my sense of self from the possibility of hurt or unwelcome intrusions into my rational and emotional equilibrium. These defenses are usually distancers from other people, like invisible shields. They were also devastating limiters when it came to dealing with those in my immediate family, which spans two wives, two broods of children over about 50 years, includes a divorce, the death of several people quite close to me, a couple of drug addiction scenarios, deaths of parents, and a change of career. Looking back on it all, my basic fear throughout it all was losing my identity if I let things get too close to me emotionally. There was always a great pull to remain a detached problem solver, a sort of safe haven, far from intimacy. After all, I was a lawyer most of my life, and that composure makes it easy to be a lawyer. In those life events I mentioned, being a detached problem solver was ineffective, absolutely useless, except maybe for the divorce. I could not make several people I love deeply healthy enough to survive. I could be support for their family, which was new turf for me, to be the nourisher and park my ego somewhere on a shelf for a while. I did my best at it. Later, when I took my ego back off the shelf, it wasn't quite the same. Surprisingly, I had added a new dimension to my arsenal of being and have been much the stronger for it over the years since. I had great difficulty really sharing myself openly with others. Then married Di, and my wife now of 20 years, a most powerful and energetic woman, as many of you know. And my fear of being subsumed under her energy and strength was pushed to the very limit. Slowly, to be sure, but nonetheless, my fear of intimacy, at least with her, though also with others, has been replaced by a faith that strength and energy are no threat, but rather a mirror in which we can see a stronger, more versatile, more evolving self who does not fear openness quite so much. I'm now pretty open to her power and am the stronger for it. I again gained, not lost, something of which I was basically afraid. One interesting anecdote in it all, many of us have experienced something like this, has to do with my relationship with grandchildren. When they were smaller, they climbed on me, hung off me like little monkeys, and were always delighted to see me. Now at college age and in college, they pursue what college kids pursue and do what they do, exactly as I did when I was that age. Ancestors and grandparents are not set aside totally by any means, but are no longer in the mainstream as they once were. As painful for me as not being a center of attention anymore plays out, they are doing absolutely what is appropriate in their lives. And I'm just about now to the point where I do not need them to change back to an inappropriate behavior for their now age. And I rejoice in them being just as they are. But even something as simple as that has not been easy and is not easy for us. Unconditional love does not presume to solve every problem one sees in the world. But it does open the lines of communication which can bring out the best eventually in every participant in our sphere of influence. It is not directive, but rather evocative. As our Montessori teacher said, I am not sure I can be any help to these kids. But the climate unconditional love creates may well produce a self-discovery that is of tremendous help to a kid, or a teen, or an adult, or even an old person. You cannot control that. It happens when and how it happens. What I do know to my very satisfaction is that moving to this form of love as we are able makes us bigger, less fearful people. My own feeble efforts have for me proved that to be true without any question whatsoever. We probably have to let go of some of our stucknesses in order to do it all, And it seems to me to involve a dissolving of our limiting ego-bound structures, particularly our fears, in order to reach a place of openness in our intimate relationships. Those I have known who have moved much further than I have moved with all this live almost totally without fear of anything. the religious mystics of history, meaning those who within Christianity, Judaism and Islam, and most certainly Buddhism and Hinduism, and also other less well-known but enduring religions, focus on the God within us, readily honoring that divinity within each person. The concept of such an open form of love is perhaps the, but always an, ultimate goal of mystical religion. So we are addressing one of, if not the, major essences of a mystical religion as it has historically existed when we speak of unconditional love. This morning's anthem from the Sufi tradition, the mystical corner of Islam, which is a face of Islam often persecuted by the Orthodox majority. But even within the orthodoxies of the world, this kind of love between individuals is surely a byproduct of their major point, that unconditional love points to God's perfect love for humankind and for individual humans, and his corollary that such love is very difficult, if not impossible, to be fully reached by individual human beings. Whatever God or God's love is or is not, the Orthodox and mystics alike agree that it is probably impossible for humans to reach perfect unconditional love, but it is nonetheless an ideal to be sought. And progress on that path is a lifetime project. Life events of every kind provide us, I'll call it grace, with movement down the path, sometimes without our even recognizing it at all. And once aware cognitively, we can work on our ego-drivenness and ego-defended processes and our fears as we are able and willing. Between the two, much progress can indeed be made. I care little for arcane theologies. I certainly do not embrace the orthodox notion of salvation. To me, salvation is not a perpetual life of our ego as we know it, in some far-off realm in the sky, sitting at the right hand of a bearded voyeur who is inordinately concerned with our sex life. Salvation, rather, just like heaven and hell, is something that plays out in our own soul as we proceed through life. I believe that salvation is not reaching perfect love, but rather being involved in its process for a lifetime. Accepting the grace we are given in that venture, and making a bit of grace of our own along the way. Such may be the path to discovery of just how large we really are. Thank you for hearing what I have to say. May we have a moment of silent meditation.